and bringing infrastructure into this community for 1,200 people to get clean water could be under construction within about a month and a half to 2 months. So that's really exciting. And yeah, we have two other projects that we're working on that are going to be groundwater well projects. They're in various stages. And another one that we are in the early stages of data collection and kind of figuring out what the solution might be for that community.
So all those are in Peru?
All of those are in Peru, yes.
And is that going to be the focus for the foreseeable future when you look at 5 or 10 year projection? Are you going to stay in that one country or does you think you'll expand?
So we really want to expand. Our board of directors and our organization as a whole is charting a path forward to 5 years from now being at a $5 million budget. We want to be in at least one to maybe two more countries fulfilling our work. And we're going to continue to stay in Peru, of course. There's still so much work to do there, and we're getting asked to go other places in Peru. But we're also getting invited to come help bring clean water to Guatemala and Bolivia. And, you know, there's just so much need, Dave. This is truly a global crisis. So we're trying to get to there and fulfill this mission that the Lord has called us on. And so kind of charting that path forward in 5 years, we want to be in at least one to two other countries.
If you had all the money in the world and all the staff in the world, how many countries would you be in? I mean, how vast would this be if you could, you know, do everything you'd like to do?
Right.
How big would this be?
Honestly, everywhere that there's a need for the clean water in communities in developing countries. I don't actually, you brought up the way you asked that question made me think of something I'd never thought of before. How many countries are affected by this?
Yeah.
I don't know that. I kind of want to go look that up now.
Anything to designate as a third world country,
any third
right?
world country yeah. you can think yeah. of, even some second world countries. But, and we try to steer away from those terms because they're kind of demeaning type of terms.
Yeah.
We use underdeveloped and developed. So undeveloped or developed. That's a more soft
right,
way to describe
it. Sounds like
it.
A ranking.
Right.
Like you're lower.
You're in third place.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is just, it's a tragic way to categorize it.
Yeah.
Right. But to add to your question, I don't know the number of countries, but I can definitely say that according to the United Nations, there are 2 billion people that lack access to clean water. That is their number. There are multiple academic peer-reviewed studies that estimate that number is closer to 4 billion.
Wow.
Now, those that are listening to this may not know what those numbers really mean. Let me just tell you, the world's population is 8 billion.
So that's half
of the world's population that don't have access to a reliable, safe source of clean water.
And when somebody on a regular basis, because everybody's going to have to drink water one way or the other, right?
Otherwise,
you're going to die.
Sure.
So you're drinking water, even if it's not great water. Is that taking years off people's lives?
Absolutely.
Is that basically they're dying at 50 rather than 80? Is it that drastic?
But then also there's a really stark statistic here. Every 90 seconds to 2 minutes, a child under the age of 5 is dying from a waterborne disease somewhere in the world. I'm a father of 3 children. Well, my wife and I are expecting again.
Now
congratulations. Now it's public. It's on the radio.
First time you announced it publicly?
Okay. No. We've told others, but not in this broad sense. I cannot imagine losing any one of my children. My oldest is not yet 6, so he would be in this category. If I was a father, putting myself in the shoes of these parents having to bury my child because they got sick drinking dirty water. It's tragic. And that's happening every 90 seconds to 2 minutes. So in the time it took me to just say that few little short sentences that I just
died.
Said there,
yeah.
one child has already died. This is a pro-life issue and it's not getting the attention that it deserves.
And that's what drives you, isn't
right?
it?
Right.
Yeah.
One of the things. And to your point, what drives me, right? So first off, it's an affront to the dignity of these people that they don't have the basic access to reliable clean water that should be a right for everyone. Two, it's a pro-life issue. These people are dying, you know, the children are dying under the age of 5 every 90 seconds to 2 minutes. You know, they're dying prematurely. They're dying at younger ages. The elderly are also disproportionately affected. It also just generally affects their overall quality of life. And that brings me to my third point. The reality is these people are stuck in their state of life survival subsistence mode, primarily in large part due to not having basic water sanitation hygiene infrastructure available to them. Because they're stuck, they don't get opportunities like you and I are having right now, Dave, to talk about what they can do or what can be done or what is going on in the world and how they can make a difference and how the Lord might be calling them to do something using the gifts, talents, and skills that he's given them. They don't even get to think about that. They can barely think about
they're just fighting for survival.
They're struggling to survive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so to me, that's the third, you know, maybe arguably the most driving factor for me now is like, I want these people to thrive. Dave, mm-hmm. I want them to thrive.
Yeah. And other than air, the most basic thing that a person needs to survive is water.
Right.
And they deserve it. So that's very well explained from their side. I never really thought about that before, that they can't just live their lives and dream and play and do what they need to do because they're just trying to fight for survival. On the other side, there's people in, you know, developed nations like America. And I think a lot of people say, I know there's a problem out there, but what am I going to do? You know, what am I going to do? Bring them, you know, gallons of water. So we feel stuck, but that's where you come in because you were guided by the Holy Spirit after you graduated. I know you went to Purdue and you started this. And so everybody can say, well, I'll support the people who are doing it. Right. I mean, that's the answer. Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Because otherwise, we don't know what to do.
Right.
We don't know.
Yeah. And you know, that's why I'm here to advocate for these people and be a voice for them. And hopefully that unlocks and moves people's hearts to say, wow, this organization is doing something and they want to help out. So absolutely come consider partnering with us.
Yeah. Have you grown in staff? I know you've got some staff members now. How big have you guys gotten?
Same number of staff members we had when I was on the radio with you last year. We still have 3 full-time staff, about the same number of volunteers, 30 volunteers in various capacities across the organization, quite a few volunteer engineers, communication support, business administration. We have our boots on the ground volunteers in Piura, Peru, where we work. One of our board members is there. We also have our project liaison. She's there on ground in country. But all that being said, you know, as I mentioned a little bit ago, we're charting this path towards a $5 million budget in 5 years from now. Mm. That's going to allow us to bring clean water to roughly 100,000 people every year, because it's about $50 per person we can bring clean water to these people on average. That's the average cost. And so what I wanted to add to that is to get to that stage, our next stage of growth is a big growth this year. We're trying to get to $600,000. And part of that $600,000, a large portion of that is going to be used to hire a full-time engineer. So I'm the only paid engineer on our team.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, I would be, and I am the critical pinch point, the limiting factor on the number of projects and the pace that we can do these projects. And so that's a big step for us to scale the growth of our organization. And so that's going to be about $100,000 annual investment, you know, salary for that engineer. So that's a big push for us this year. That is something will be our next stage of labor growth.
Yeah. So you want to hire another Jacob? I mean, somebody with the same skill set as you,
sure.
So you can multiply because you're only one person, right? You can only do so much. Jacob Niemeyer is my guest, executive director of Vera Aqua Vera Vita. Go to givetruewater.org. Givetruewater.org. You can find out all about their mission, how you can donate and support them. And also, as we're going to talk about here in a few minutes, walking in the footsteps of Pope Leo XIV, a Peruvian mission and pilgrimage is very exciting. One other question, if I may, about the 4 projects that you're doing now in Peru and expanding and getting to the $5 million budget eventually within 5 years. Once you complete a project and it's providing sustainable water for a community, are you able to walk away from it, or do you continue to maintain it and have, how does that work? How does that long-term continue to provide sustainable water?
No, absolutely. Our approach is we work with these communities to empower them and equip them and train them and educate them so that after the solutions are implemented, there's a transition period where we hand off ownership to them and then they take it over and they run it and it's self-sufficient because they manage it, maintain it. We help them form what we call a clean water system committee. We have a very formal training process that we walk these communities through that is solution specific to each solution in, you know, each particular community, that they're always generally a little bit different. And so there's some different training that we have to do for the operators specifically, but we also help them with leadership formation and training. We help them. You can think of the Clean Water System Committee like a small board of directors, president, vice president, treasurer, secretary. We help them set up the economics of it to make it sustainable. So we help them set up affordable water rate system so that they can sell the water that is enough to, at bare minimum, maintain status quo operations, ideally be a little bit above that, so they're setting some aside for future system expansions and improvements. And we do all that to ensure that after we leave, they are fully autonomous, can operate it themselves. And so if we want to put this in Catholic terms, which we do, this is kind of what our guiding principles are: solidarity. We're walking with them until they are self-sufficient, subsidiarity, like at the lowest body of operation. Yeah. We cannot and nor should we do that for them, because it's not something that, one, is resourcing capacity possible, but two, it's not really in keeping with the dignity of the person if we're going to continue to do that for them. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we empower them, equip them, train them, educate them, they can be self-sufficient. And the truth is, that's how we change the narrative, and that's how we change the trajectory of this problem, where it's not handout systems, it's hand-ups, it's transformation, and then they become self-sufficient and self-sustained. And I have two other things I'd love to share with you that we're doing in that regard.
Certainly.
And so one of the things is, to get to that point, we also have to have really good education. Water, sanitation, and hygiene, general education. Plus, we're also wanting to bring an encounter with the living water of Jesus Christ to these people. So we do that through the lens of the theology of the body. And so we actually just last fall, we had a team of students from my alma mater, shout out to Purdue University, in their EPICS department, do a project for us to help scale up our current education workshop, which currently is structured such that it requires us and our team on our mission trips every year to go into each of the communities that we're serving and implement. It's like 3-4 hour sessions, general water, sanitation, hygiene, plus theology of the body. And it helps us reach these people that we're serving, but it's not, you know, self-replicating. It doesn't have this decentralized expansion type of structure to it. So that's what this project at Purdue was for us, was to help us build up that scalable model. And now we have a path forward. And on this trip coming up this summer, which I know we're going to talk about, we're going to be implementing this process where we come into a community, we do our education workshop, but then we raise up champions in that community. They become trainers. We train the trainers. We equip them with a starter kit of all the materials that they need, like a workshop in a box, a kit with all the print materials and all the hand-on stuff for the activities that we do, that they can then go and take and bring this education workshop to the neighboring communities around them. Because here's the reality. These people don't know what they don't know. They don't know what life is like with clean water. They don't know that when they go to the bathroom next to their water source, they're going to contaminate their water. They don't know if they have or are given clean water, if they live in an open air environment, they don't know to not put to put a lid on top of their container, because otherwise within a couple of days that clean water is now no longer going to be clean if they don't put a lid on it. Basic sanitation and hygiene stuff. That's how we can transform these people. So it's obviously it's water, physical water, but it's also education. That they're kind of, they go hand in hand, like a, you know, a glove on your hand.
And like you said, with the subsidiarity, you can teach teachers to teach the next generation, because you're going to have you know, every generation retaught on these lessons.
Right. So, and we want to put ourselves out of business. I'm going to say it bluntly. We should not have to exist. The fact that we exist is only out of necessity. And so we want to do everything that we can to transform the next generation of these people.
All right. Well, let's talk about the mission and pilgrimage. This is very exciting. With Pope Leo the 14th having spent so much time in Peru and having such a connection there, Sunday, July 26th through Sunday, August 9th, which is, what, 2 weeks? Is that what that is? Two full weeks? You guys are going to go out there. I know you already have almost a couple of dozen people signed up for this by now, but tell us, let me read the first paragraph and then you fill in the blanks, and you've got a great chaplain. That's quite exciting. Mm-hmm. In the summer of 2026, Vera Aqua Vera Vida invites you to Peru for a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to serve communities in need and walk in the footsteps of the church's living legacy. Participants may choose to join the mission trip, the pilgrimage, or both, each offering a distinct yet deeply connected encounter with faith, culture, and human dignity. So tell us how this came about. What's it going to be all about?
Yeah, so the whole Pope Leo name or aspect of this trip came about thanks to the fact that we now have our wonderful Pope Leo the 14th, who is in fact himself a Peruvian citizen. He was a bishop of Peru for like 20 years in the Diocese of Chiclayo. And last year, actually prior to last year's mission trip, we were already initially kicking around the idea of doing a pilgrimage as a way to make the experience more spiritually enriching for those that travel with us to Peru, but also as a means to maybe draw other people in that would maybe not otherwise consider going on a trip like this because of mission trip and the connotation that has. It's going to be kind of, it's going to be work and it's going to be effort and, you know, it's not going to be a vacation. And so we wanted to really reach people that may be interested, but would look for something more spiritually enriching. And so the pilgrimage was such an obvious connection. And then when Pope Leo was selected to be Pope, it was just a perfect fit. We were like, why don't we just, you know, in a sense, co-opt that his name and his connection to Peru as a way to really get people excited about this opportunity to go to Peru with us.
Let me ask you, when he was announced and he mm-hmm. came out on the balcony, mm-hmm. did you already know that he had a connection to Peru? Had you already heard of him, or was he a stranger that you had never heard of before?
God's providence is always incredible. Literally about a week before, one of my board members, Daniel Hennessy Jr., or not Jr., he doesn't go by Jr., but Daniel Hennessy, he sent me an email with a link to an article from a Catholic news agency or a news source. I don't remember which it was. And it was just talking about Cardinal Prevost and how he had all these connections to Peru and how he was kind of in the possibility of the running of being
really?
The next
wow.
pope. And I read the article and my board member said, we need to reach out to this Cardinal Prevost and connect and tell him about what we're doing in Peru. And I said, absolutely. Little did I know, a little over a week later, he was selected
to
be our pope.
To get in touch with, yeah.
But we were able to. We actually got a letter to him last fall, and he wrote us back from that. Well, through the apostolic nuncio, wrote us back, and we have a wonderful letter from him. He said, we're praying for remission. I'm praying for remission.
I think you're the first person I've ever talked to that had some kind of predilection that he might be elected pope. I mean, nobody. I mean, I've talked to people, and nobody had any idea that
right.
I mean, he was just kind of came out of the blue. But okay, we're down to a few minutes. What else can you tell people maybe about the cost and you know, what exactly do they need to do? Obviously get their passport and that kind of thing, but
for sure.
This is really just a few months from now that you're
right.
that you're leaving. So more details.
Yeah, so we are, as you read in the little narrative there, we are selling the trip separately, and part of that is because we know some people that they don't want to go for 2 weeks. That's a long time commitment for them. Also, they may just be interested in the pilgrimage and the pilgrimage alone. And that's still meaningful and valuable because there's still going to be the infusion of the Vera Aqua Vera Vida mission. And folks are going to be going from that are on the mission trip are also some are going to be going on the pilgrimage. So there'll be that crossover. And it's also a means to help us reach a lot of new people. So the mission trip is from August 3rd. Sorry, the mission trip is from July 26th to August 3rd, and the pilgrimage is from August 3rd to August 9th. And the total cost, rough estimate for the mission trip is $750 owed to Vera Aqua Vera Vida for food, lodging, and everything in country in Peru while we're there, ground transportation and all. Plus a rough estimate of about $1,500 for your flights, which you would buy on your own, coming out to be about $2,250 just for that 1 week of the mission trip.
Okay.
The pilgrimage is total cost for all the in-country stuff, including all the airfare and all ground transportation in-country, because we're going to multiple spots in Peru. We're going to the Diocese of Chiclayo, where Pope Leo was bishop. We're going to Lima to see some amazing Catholic sites there, where there were five contemporary saints living at the same time, St. Rosa Lima, St. Martin de Porres, to name two of them. Going to Cusco, and of course Machu Picchu, one of the cultural and national heritages of Peru and the Incan Empire at the time that built it. And so what's really incredible is all that cost for the whole thing, for all that in-country stuff with the pilgrimage, all the hotels, food, and everything is $3,980.
Okay.
And our incredible spiritual leaders for that pilgrimage are going to be our chaplain, Father Mitch Pacwa of EWTN fame, and Evan Lemoyne, who is one of the premier teachers and speakers on the theology of the body in Latin America. Mm.
So Father Mitch Becker is your chaplain.
He's our chaplain.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I didn't realize that. Well, that is awesome. So it looks like if you wanted to do both weeks, it would be approximately $6,200. You just add those two together, approximately
right.
$4,000, and then $2,250. All right. If that intrigues you, by all means, go to this website, givetruewater.org, givetruewater.org.
Yeah, and we have a banner at the top of our page on the website for the mission trip and pilgrimage. So as soon as you get to the website, you should be able to click on that and go learn more and sign up. And we'd love for you to come with us. It's going to be an incredible experience.
Okay. Well, thanks. You always bring a wealth of information. It's always great to get an update from you. We'd have to wait another year to do it, the next one. But Jacob Niemeyer, Executive Director and Founder of Vera Aqua, Vera Vita, givetruewater.org. If you just want to donate, if you want to volunteer, they've always got this speakeasy event that they do every year. Okay, it's events, fundraisers, and so just learn more about their mission on that website, givetruewater.org. Thank you very much, Jacob.
Thanks
you, Cecil, for running the board, and I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your weekend. God bless you.
Are you an experienced human resources professional looking to put your talents and expertise to work in a truly meaningful way? The Catholic Diocese of Dallas is hiring a benefits manager and a senior HRIS analyst to lead and support the people who serve our church and community every day. If you have strong experience managing employee benefits or HR systems, and you're a practicing Catholic ready to serve with purpose, we'd love to hear from you. Learn more and apply at dallascatholic.org/careers and search benefits manager or senior HRIS analyst.
Thank you so much for joining us on the North Texas Interview of the Week here on the Guadalupe Radio Network as we talk about cool Catholic things. We're broadcasting on 9:10 a.m. to the east and also 11:40 a.m. KCPP to the west. And if you are listening today, we're glad that you are here. We have, proving again today that the topics of this show are really eclectic. And I must say that the topic that we're about to talk about today, I don't think I've ever spoken about on this program, which is hard to believe because I think I've spoken about everything under the sun, and this is going to be about the game of chess. And back in January, I was over at Mary Immaculate Parish promoting the car raffle, and afterwards a kind gentleman came up, bought some raffle tickets for the car, and he told me that he ran the chess club there at Mary Immaculate for the school and also at JP2. That intrigued me, and I said, let's do an interview, and here he is. And so his name is Robert Griffin, and he serves, in addition to those positions I mentioned about running the chess clubs at Mary Immaculate Catholic School and John Paul II Catholic High School, he is the director of the John W. Griffin Memorial Chess Scholarship Fund. And among other things, he's going to be telling us about an upcoming fourth annual Dallas Scholastic Invitational Chess Tournament for Catholic school students grade 3rd through 12th. It's going to be Sunday, April 26th at the Farmers Branch Recreation Center in Farmers Branch. And so with no further ado, Robert, thanks for being here. This is an interesting topic.
Oh, thank you, David. I'm so blessed to be here. This is exciting.
I've always enjoyed the game of chess. I have a chess board in my house. I must say that I don't play very often because it does take a little investment in time, and you also have to find somebody that enjoys the game as much as you do. Clearly, you love it. And
absolutely,
that John W. Griffin, whom I mentioned is your father. And yes. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your upbringing, your family, and how this love of chess came about in your life?
Well, my parents were first generation immigrants. My father's family came in from Newfoundland through from Ireland, and my mother's family came in through New York through Poland. And so they were both born here as first generation Americans. And so they grew up loving board games, loving cards, loving anything that had to do with physical interaction or social interaction. In fact, my dad actually owned an Arthur Murray studio for a period of time.
Mm.
So growing up, I'm the last of six kids. And so it was a nice Catholic family. All of us got baptized and confirmed, and we went through the whole procedure for being a Catholic. And I grew up in Rhode Island. So there's a St. Bernard's Catholic Church right there in Wickford. And so that's where I went to catechism. That's where I went to church. And then when I got married, we got married in a Catholic church down in Puerto Vallarta. Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Well, a nice tie-in to our network there yes. as well. And I think Rhode Island might be the most Catholic state in the country. I think percentage-wise, there's a lot of Catholics up there
There's a lot of Catholics up there.
Your dad, whom this Memorial Chess Scholarship Fund is named after, it was an exceptional chess player, as you told me beforehand. Talk about that, and what's the purpose of the fund?
The purpose of the fund is to memorialize not only my father, who taught me how to play chess and gave me the inspiration to want to teach others how to play chess, but to also create a scholarship method to be able to give a little bit of reward, a little bit of funding to those kids, especially in the Catholic schools, who have an interest in chess. Chess is a multi-layered, multifaceted game, and it really speaks to a strategy. It speaks to forward thinking. And a lot of kids, you know, they play soccer, they play baseball, and they have to learn strategy, but not like chess.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to chess, like in any sport, if you think basketball, you think Michael Jordan. If you think, baseball, Babe Ruth or something like that, there are certain legendary names in mm-hmm. chess. I think of Bobby Fischer.
Right.
More recently, a name that people may or may not be familiar with is a gentleman by the name of Magnus Carlsen.
Yes.
Who has been the world's top player for a while, from what you could say he no longer is. But talk about some of these folks who have put chess on the map, so to speak.
Well, it is always good for chess to have an interesting character. Bobby Fischer was very odd in the sense that he had very peculiarities when he played, and sometimes people felt he was difficult. Magnus was very vocal, and there's a lot of women getting into chess now, and they're trying to promote not just from a social point of view, but women can do it too.
Yeah, yeah. Has it largely been a male-dominated sport up until now?
Up until the 70s, it was nearly exclusively a male-dominated sport. But there's actually a new movie on, I think it's Netflix, that talks about the first female grandmaster.
Is that right?
Yeah, and it's an amazing story because it shows her struggle. She was an amazing player, but then when she got up to that very, very top level, she still wasn't respected until years and years into it when she could prove herself.
Very nice. And the game of chess, I guess a little surprised that the competition here starts with third graders.
Oh, yeah.
Do you recommend starting young? Is there an advantage for that? And the secondary question is, what kind of life skills does a young person learn by becoming proficient in chess?
So the younger, the better. Like myself, we had a chess table in the house. And so from the time that I could sit at the board, I was taught how to move the pieces. And I encourage the parents to make a judgment call. We do accept kinder through second in the program, but they have to have a sense of patience. They have to have a sense of forward thinking. When you get to about third grade, that's when you can self-monitor, and we find that the kids have a little bit more self-interest in the game.
And you teach skills of chess. How do you do that?
Well, it's different in the elementary and middle school than it is in the high school. And you've said that we do two different chess programs. The elementary and the middle school is primarily focused on the early games. It's how the pieces move, the simple strategy. The high school is much more involved into multi-level strategy. It's end game. It's how do you position your opponent? Because a lot of it is like poker, meaning you're not playing the pieces, you're playing your opponent.
Mm-hmm. And you have to kind of get into their head a little bit and
right.
figure out what they're going to do next. A lot of strategy. I asked you about this before we started, but you know, when you have a player called a bishop, mm-hmm. and then you got a king and a queen, which has, you know, roots in Catholicism. Is there a Catholic history of chess, or can you talk about where chess originated and maybe some of the flashpoints historically of the game of chess?
Well, I'm not to assume that I know all of the different dates, but I do know that chess originated in India. And I believe that over the course of time, the pieces have developed from what they originally were into what they are now. And one of the things is the bishop that you mentioned. I believe it actually started as an elephant. And so through a morphing of the physical character, it turned into what it is today, and it got absorbed as a bishop because kings and queens come in and they want to play the game or have their people play that game. And elephant is not necessarily a king or queen kind of a name.
Mm-hmm. So how popular is chess now? Does it fluctuate, you know, and kind of come in and out of popularity, or is there always going to be some core group at any school that wants to be in a chess club? Like, for example, how many people are regularly coming to chess meetings at Mary Immaculate and JP2?
At Mary Immaculate, we have, I believe, 22 people on the roster, and we have a constant between 16 and 18 show up. You know, the kids don't show up for a variety of reasons, you know, sick that day, have a sport, have a test, whatever. In the high school, we have a strong group. In fact, we just took the yearbook picture and we had 12 kids show up. And we have a strong, you know, 6-8 kids show up on a weekly basis for that. And part of the reason that I wanted this fund and I wanted this organization was to not segment chess players into that, you know, I wear glasses, I'm a little nerdy, I'm not part of the regular group. I focus a lot of importance on the socialization aspect of chess. So when those kids come in the elementary and middle school, it's not a high-pressure situation. It's not you have to move everything correctly. It's more about acceptance of your friends that this is a great game and that we're going to learn it all together. We do great puzzles and all kinds of team activities.
One thing you mentioned is about how chess can teach patience. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I was a little surprised about the last time I went on YouTube and was watching chess tournaments is that a lot of it, at least maybe at the high level, is timed.
Yes.
And really fast. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just the experts where they had to every single, I mean, they were making moves sometimes in 2 seconds.
Yes.
And is that the norm or is that just at the highest level?
So there's two kinds of chess. There's timed chess, which you'll get in a tournament situation. It could be as much as 10 minutes per player, or it could be as much as 90 minutes per player. And those are the ones for the national tournaments. They want to give enough time for the player to make a conscious decision without feeling rushed. Then on the other side, there's speed chess. And speed chess is where you set the clock for, say, 90 seconds or 2 minutes, and everybody is constantly moving, hitting the button, moving, hitting the button. And that's what you're referring to.
And what happens if you run out of time? The game's over?
You lose.
Yep. Yeah, and I've seen, you know, Magnus Carlsen, because he's a bit of a showman.
Yes.
And I saw him one time just let his time go down mm-hmm. to like, you know, 15 seconds or something. And he was that confident that that's all he would need. It was a little cocky, but you know, but that's all part of the strategy, is that there's an intimidation factor that I guess at the high levels as well.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, Robert Griffin is my guest. He is the executive director of the John W. Griffin Memorial Chess Scholarship Fund, and named after his father, who was a very, very successful chess player. Did your dad do it just as a hobby, or was he like, I guess let me put it this way, can people make money playing chess?
So in the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer, there's a scene where Josh Waitkin comes in as a young boy, and the chess instructor is talking to the father. And he goes through the room and he asks the chess masters in the room in the social club how much they made for each of the last tournaments that they played. When you are just playing socially, there's no money in chess. Mm-hmm. But there is some money in the higher levels. It's not like baseball money, but, you know, it's some.
Yeah, yeah.
To give you an example, there's a group that sponsored an India versus U.S. chess tournament, and they did that over in Arlington, and it was a big deal.
Arlington, Texas?
Yeah.
Oh, Arlington, really?
Yeah, and so it was, we had people come from a large regional area to come and watch these masters from India come in and play.
What was the purse?
I don't remember exactly what the purse was, but it was, they sold tickets to it and they sold out and they had t-shirts and it was a great event.
Yeah, very good. Let's talk about the event coming up at the end of the month. Again, 4th annual Dallas Scholastic Invitational Chess Tournament. Catholic school students, grades 3 through 12, Sunday, April 26th at the Farmers Branch Recreation Center. You've been doing this for a few years now.
Yes.
Is this something you created? Is this your, okay. And it's all part of this Memorial Chess Scholarship Fund, I presume.
Yes.
What do people need to know about this?
They need to know that I think there's 34 schools that are officially in the DFW diocese. Every student from every one of those schools, including Notre Dame, is allowed to participate at no charge in the tournament.
Mm.
I have been going to great lengths to get sponsorships from fun stuff. We get Canes, Chick-fil-A, Taco Bueno on the food side, easy stuff to give out gift cards. We have a bowling package that we got this year as a sponsorship. These are all things that we give to the as prizes for the trophies, but the real meaning is the scholarship awards. So 3rd grade through 12th grade each gets its own increasingly larger scholarship, with it being $1,000 for the winner for the 12th grade.
And that goes towards their education?
It does.
Is that what it is?
Mm-hmm.
And this is coming from your fund.
Mm-hmm.
And how are you a 501c3? Raising money? How do you, you know, who's supporting this? And, you know, if somebody's listening right now and says, mm-hmm, I want to support this, tell us about the funding aspect.
So the funding aspect is all organic. We rely 100% on donations and the work that we do for sponsors that come in. We don't necessarily have any corporate sponsors other than the sponsorships that I get from individuals and people who donate to help run that annual event.
Students do you anticipate will be competing in this? How big will it be?
We usually have between 50 and 100. And so that fills up the rec center. And we picked the rec center. This being a Catholic event, you would think, well, why don't you have it at one of the schools? The design of the Farmers Branch Rec Center is so conducive to what we do. They have a separate parent room where all the parents, it's large enough to hold all the parents. We have a vendor table, we have concessions, we have shirts, we have all the trophies. And then across the hall, we have the setup area where the kids play their matches. So they can play the matches in peace and quiet. The parents aren't allowed in that room. And then they come back and they can hang out with the parents. And there's even a recreational center outside with, jungle gym, volleyball. They can even go swimming across in the next building. So it's a great facility.
And is it single elimination?
No. The way we do it is as a Swiss tournament. So each student who signs up will play four games, whether they win or lose. And so we record the winners as the people with the best record after the four games.
Okay. And if somebody is listening or a parent is listening and saying, well, my kid, you know, just on his own plays chess. He's not part of any chess club at a school. He can enter, right? Or she can enter. You don't have to have any prerequisites as long as you want to just get in there.
As long as you are a student at a documented Catholic school in the DFW diocese, you can enter. There's no requirement for any experience or belonging to a chess club.
My guest is Robert Griffin. He is serving as the director of the John W. Griffin Memorial Chess Scholarship Fund. And I think it's jwgchessfund.com is the website if you want to learn more. Fourth annual Dallas Scholastic Invitational Chess Tournament for Catholic school students, grade 3rd through 12th, Sunday, April 26th at the Farmers Branch Recreation Center. I should ask, it's called Dallas. If somebody is at a Catholic school in Fort Worth or Tyler or, you know, do they need to be at a Dallas school or is this anybody, any school?
So for the time being, it is the Dallas Diocese. And so it is our goal to expand the tournament and possibly in the next few years be able to include the Fort Worth Diocese. When we started as a small chess club that had two or three members in a library. And now we've, you know, years later, we've developed into multiple schools having clubs with an annual tournament and a foundation to back it. So.
And who's better at chess, the computer or the human being? And there have been those competitions, haven't there?
Yes.
Can the human still beat the computer?
I guess it depends on the program. But, yeah, they make pretty tough computer programs these days.
And I know a lot of people are thinking, I've never heard of this, Magnus Carlsen, but he definitely had hit my radar even before I met you. But who's the number one in the world now? Do you know the name?
Not off the top of my head.
Somebody beat him, and because he had been number one for a number of years. Yeah, very, very interesting. So is there a cost to sign up? What do people need to know if they want to, sign up for this tournament?
So one of the fantastic things about the tournament is I've made a determination that the student can play in the tournament for free if they so desire. However, there is a small note on the registration that says it costs me approximately $37.50 to host this tournament for each of the kids who sign up. So that way, there's no way somebody who can't afford can't play.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, I accept everybody who signs up. And that's why we are looking for additional donors, additional generous sponsors to help us cover those costs that we can.
Yeah, and you can find out more about that, jwgchessfund.com. Can I give out the phone number?
Absolutely.
Yeah, 972-814-5795, 972-814-5795. To the person who is listening, whether they be, in fifth grade or 90 years old, and just this interview is like, you know what? I never learned how to play chess. I don't even know how the players move and, what the rook does and the bishop does. Well, how would you recommend they learn the game of chess if they're interested?
That is an excellent question. And how you would learn is to go out. There are two platforms. If you are a younger child, say under the age of 12, you go out to chesskid.com. And that has a lot of robots. It has a lot of puzzles. It's very friendly for children. Outsiders can't message you, that kind of stuff. Once you're above the age of about 12 and you know the game, you're going to go to chess.com. Those are the two standards. But there's a few other sites.
If you were playing chess right now against me, okay, what would your first move? Would it be a pawn, one, two, or would it be a knight?
Because
those are really the only things you can do for your first move, right?
Correct. You can only move on your first move one of the pawns in the front row or one of the knights because the knights can go over the pawns.
Yeah.
So if I had never played you before, I'd probably do king to d4. If I had played you before, I might open up with, a g to g3. Ponda G3 because that is a different way. After you castle, it's a protected area.
It's a fascinating game. How many, on a typical week, how many games of chess do you play and who do you play with?
Well, I play on the app, the chess.com app. And
is that with a human being or a computer?
No, with the computer. I play against the computer because sometimes I'll get interrupted in the middle of my game and I don't want to lose the game. So It's easier for me to play against a computer that will pause rather than try and play somebody live.
Yeah. So you're playing a game right now. I mean, you're actively involved in the game while you're waiting for the interview to start?
I was playing before while I was waiting in the lobby. Yeah.
It's enjoyable, isn't it?
It's frustratingly enjoyable, yes.
Yeah, yeah, that is so fascinating. Well, I'm just down to our last couple of minutes. I was really looking forward to this interview because like I said at the beginning, it's something unique. It's not something I typically talk about on Catholic radio, but there's certainly a Catholic angle when this is a Dallas Scholastic Invitational Chess Tournament. And just want to encourage everybody to, you know, first of all, if you want to support this financially, JWGChessFund.com, or you can call Robert 972-814-5795. The important thing to know is that this tournament is going to be Sunday, April 26th, Farmers Branch Recreation Center, 3rd through 12th graders registered at a Catholic school. So we got 1 minute remaining. Robert, what else do you want to tell our listeners?
We're always accepting volunteers for the event. And then also, the reason why we went from Mary Immaculate and then expanded to JP2 is because people know about the tournament and schools that don't have chess programs are reaching out to me. In fact, a brand new school called St. Constantine over in Irving, I'm going to meet with them to help them start their chess program.
Oh, wow. This is cool. That's very nice. Well, thanks for coming out. Great to see you again. Robert Griffin, again, I just want to real quickly give out the website and also I'll give an email and a phone number, jwgchessfund.com. The email is director@jwgchessfund.com. The phone number is 972-814-5795. I'd love to think that 5 or 10 more people signed up for this tournament because of this interview. And the tournament will be Sunday, April 26th. And this is for 3rd through 12th graders. Boy or girl signed up and registered at a local Catholic school in the Dallas Diocese at the Farmers Branch Recreation Center. So thank you very much, Robert. Thanks to Teresita for running the board. Thank you for listening. And if you have suggestions for future interviews, you can always email me, DavePalmer@grnonline.com. God bless you. Have a great rest of your weekend. Oh, that was fun.
Yeah.
That was easy, right?
I worked up a sweat.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I was
getting a little nervous.
Thanks for joining us for this week's KATH 910 AM Interview of the Week. We hope you've enjoyed this presentation of Catholic news and information pertinent to North Texas Catholics. Please join us again next week at this same time for another KATH 910 AM Interview of the Week.
Would you like to experience a true renewal of the Spirit on a Harvest Journeys pilgrimage? You can walk in the footsteps of Jesus, Mary, and the saints, pray at the sacred sites of Fatima, Lourdes, Italy, the Holy Land, and beyond, and encounter places where faith has been lived for centuries. Each pilgrimage is centered on reflection, fellowship, and a deeper encounter with God. You can visit harvestjourneys.com to book your pilgrimage. That's harvestjourneys.com, a sponsor of the GRN.
Thanks for listening to KATH 910 AM Frisco Dallas Fort Worth on the Guadalupe Radio Network in North Texas. Catholic radio for your soul. Heard also at grnonline.com and on your smartphone.